again, we have the command line here, and this is a direct annual, a three, in some cases, a 4 year.
Another advantage of the kind of mining technology is for them by using the Google request. It's not supposed to be hard to get any, and you know, it's simpler when you think we can the other day. And I said, well, how did you happen
to learn it? The very interesting thing that I found in my life work that I really enjoyed, and it was done from the extra energy and then the putting the beam
back.
I think they were in general, I was very fortunate in my present. And going over the instrument, and yeah, I think I go back a few years. But Norman Rockwell was my teacher there. And after 2 years in this time, we got the right, I think, two things like that, and two pairs of instruments, Uncle Sam Button, and I was in first, where it was. Then, upon doing this job, I went to the ECQ. For 2 months, the first month I was there, I was talking up to maybe the 15-year-old station, and helping out financially as well as doing the work that was good for me to do anyway.
Yes.
And after about 2 years, I worked at Howard Hanson. And since I got my degree,
So you had all the academics requirements for this time.
Yeah, I did. And the interesting thing for me was that I through all these years, I did always have almost as much time as I would have wanted to think about. And being able to have some of the extra input, I think, is very helpful later in life, if not at the moment.
Yes.
And so, in general, I think I can grasp that experience in that way.
You think so? Certainly, yes. Did you go to Iran in
the study? Well, after the study of the Eastern School, for my so-called PhD composition requirement, I wrote a symphony, and by chance it was played by the New York Philharmonic. I think it went rather well. Arthur Lubinsky was supposed to do it, and it was during that week that he decided to leave for the New York Philharmonic and go to the Chicago Orchestra. And the assistant conductor at that time, and a moment later, with Waldo Hendel, and with one rehearsal, I think, is all we had left. He did the symphony the rest of the program. And nevertheless, it came off rather well. I was happy about that.
Waldo did the rehearsal.
And then, at the end of that concert,
I stayed there for about, as a teacher in composition for 10 years, and then I took a year off and went abroad on a combination Guggenheim and Fulbright fellowship. And while I was there, I was offered the directorship of the Peabody, and I came back for the premiere of a piano concerto George Zell had commissioned. And while here, all of that was confirmed. So in 1958, I moved to Baltimore, and I was there for 4 years, at which time the position of the president of DUSART became vacant, and that was offered, and of course I accepted. And I've been there ever since 1962.
It was that long ago.
Yeah.
Hallelujah.
The time does fly, but there it is.
And you really give us the whole story of today, practically.
It comes up through the present moment, that part of my life. And
now, all this time, of course, you were busy composing, as you say.
Yeah.
You had sufficient time to do what was necessary.
Well, almost sufficient time. There are times when you're really trying to finish a piece when you don't have enough time and you have interruptions.
Yes.
But I like to gripe like any composer does at certain moments. But in general, there's been time. And I think some people can do several things. I happen to like being involved in the conservatory very much because you hear great young talents and they provoke you and at the same time stimulate you into ideas, and you're in a place where there's a lot of activity in music. And since I happen to be a night writer anyway, I like to have 4 or 5 or 6 hours at night to work.
Mm-hmm. Can you describe a typical day for us, if there is such a thing in your life?
Approximately, yeah. I get up like anybody else does, and I try to do about an hour's work in the morning, but not very much more. And then I go to the graveyard, and that kind of keeps me busy. And many a night there are concerts at Juilliard or at the Philharmonic or at the Met, other places. And something around 11:30 or so, I begin when the city gets quiet. We talked about the sound in New York. Around this time, the whole traffic pattern reduces, and New York does become much more quiet. And frankly, for me, it's a much better time to work. And I work until about 3 or 4, depending on, you know, the stimulus and how it's going, and then I go to bed. And
then what time do you have to?
Well, I get up about 8:30 or 9, and maybe 10.
So you're busy. They are the 2 parts.
Yeah.
Are you able to play your piano?
I never write at the piano anyway.
And
for better or for worse, I was born with a perfect pitch, and I've never written at the piano. Ever since I was a little boy, and so that on rare occasions I may touch something, but the writing is that all I need is quiet. Noise does trouble me, but needing a piano does not. For some reason, one year in '68, when I went to Europe on one of the last voyages of the Liberté, I was able to finish my cello concerto. There was no piano there. I prefer writing away from the piano.
Now, did you discover your perfect pitch before you studied solfeggio as a young boy, or a long
time? I don't know. They came so close. I honestly never remembered which came first, because
the two so often go together.
They go together, and at the same time, from the very beginning, this teacher, even at the very first lesson, asked me to turn away. He wanted to check whether I had perfect pitch or not. And he asked me, you know, what note is this and what note is that, and I was able to get it. And from that basis, he developed a little bit more a slightly different approach to solfeggio, because I did have perfect pitch. He told me at a later date that had I not had perfect pitch, he would have gone in a different direction. What that direction would have been, I don't know. But they came so close together that I really find them going in parallel.
It's interesting about composers that there are some that work with the piano and others that don't.
It doesn't really matter. The results are the only thing that matter. No, just as you would think that for a conductor, perfect pitch would be a great advantage. Well, it is in some cases, and it is not in others. Because sometimes you can get so wedded to the so-called ideal pitch that in an orchestra that does not exist.
That's right.
And you waste time for the wrong reasons. But, I mean, somebody with a practical sense of perfect pitch will adjust to the circumstances that he needs. So I find it an advantage up to a certain point, but not so great an advantage in other ways.
Well, now after the writing of your first symphony and successful performance in New York, what about the second one?
No, actually, if I could flip back, that was number 3. I had written the second symphony, and it won the first Gerstner Memorial Prize. That was the first real award I ever got. That's when they were trying to honor George Gershwin, and at that time I had written the symphony, and I was still a student, and Bernard Rogers thought I ought to enter it, and because if I won, I would win $1,000, and looking at me, and I was somewhat of a scarecrow at the moment, he thought a little extra money and food wouldn't hurt me, you know. So what he did...
Have you always been friendly?
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah.
What happened was that he was the one that put that score in the mail for me, because I really didn't know about prizes or anything else, and I'm eternally grateful to him for having
done
that.
He was a delightful person. I met him in London, and we talked about the tradition, and if I'm not mistaken, this piece, the Japanese pieces, were mm-hmm. played just before or just after years of that.
I think they were just a little bit before, yeah.
Yeah,
and he really was a marvelous orchestrator, and he knew the orchestra very well, and he was a fine teacher, I thought.
Yes, I always heard that.
But on top of that, he was a fine human being, as this little instance, in my case, demonstrates, because he sent it off, and when the telegram came indicating that I had won $1,000 and could I come to New York, it took me about a day to remember what this was all about. And I did, and that was a time the members of the New York Philharmonic gave a concert at the Metropolitan Opera House, and in that case, Leonard Bernstein, it was one of his early engagements after having substituted for Bruno Walter.
Yeah.
And so the premiere of that took place there. That was before this third symphony, which took place with the New York Philharmonic that I mentioned a little earlier. The first symphony was another student work. It was a very long symphony, and only two movements had ever been played of that. It was about 55 minutes long, and Howard Hanson played two of the movements. I think he felt at the time that perhaps playing all four would take an ungodly part of the program when there were many other composers that he was reading and helping in the reading. So two movements were read of that.
Was Howard Hanson a strong influence on your career?
I think that he was very helpful in the sense, when I was writing, I've always had the yearn to listen to what I've written. And in a funny sort of way, I've learned the most in terms of being able to hear what I've written, so that I went to the Eastman School knowing that composers of orchestral music could get a hearing.
Yes.
And indeed, my very first year, just two movements of the symphony was read, so that I learned a great deal, and during those sessions, I don't think that Howard Hanson was an influence in a musical way,
mm-hmm.
Because my music has gone in other directions.
Yes.
But I would say it was an influence in terms of not only helping me, there are so many young composers whose music he read, recorded, played through, that I think that it was it's a special place in music history, American music history, I think.
I think you're going to say that, yeah, very.
And I simply was one of those young people who loved the orchestra, loved to write for the orchestra, and here was a place, as far as I was concerned, probably the only place in the country that was reading the piece, and then the recordings were made so that you could go back to your little room and listen to what you did and make corrections,
mm-hmm.
which was, for me, the most helpful thing of all.
Sure. Sure.
And so I think that's been a great help to many, many composers. I remember hearing he did a lot of music of all composers, pieces of Aaron Copland, William Schumann as well in those days,
mm-hmm.
on those festivals. It was of no one school.
No.
And I think that was the beauty of it.
Yeah, yeah. The pieces were eclectic.
Absolutely. And though he had his own way as a composer, when it came to presenting scores with the orchestra, I think it was very broad range.
Mm. I really never knew him. I met him once or twice, but I certainly admire what he did. We sent a commission to him, and he was one of the two or three that I don't know whether he accepted it or not, but at least he never got around to keep doing it. And since we were really, for the most part, reaching out towards composers who didn't get commissions readily, we didn't pursue the matter. I'm not quite sure what the state of
affairs. Well, I think that in those days he was recording a great deal of American composers, his own music,
yeah.
So that he had a special series where his own music was recorded by himself. and perform by himself. It's, when you have that opportunity, I suppose,
you
might as well go ahead and do it.
Sure.
So,
well, your career seems to, as you already indicated, have an unusually happy and smooth path.
Well, I don't know if it was very smooth with the listeners. It was something that I feel I was either destined to do or put it on the lower level that I simply wanted to do.
Yeah.
And I had my moments as older composers discouraging me from writing orchestral music since, quote, nobody would ever play it. And nevertheless, I was interested in the orchestra, and to this day, I love it as an instrument,
mm-hmm.
And I love writing for it.
Mm-hmm.
There have been many other works in connection with the orchestra, but and chamber music, but the orchestra is a very special instrument to me.
So you don't agree with some of the best pronouncements about the future of the symphony?
Oh, not only do I not agree with it, I think it's laughable that those statements are made. And I don't think the people who make them really believe them. It's just, in general, somewhat sour grapes.
Yeah, I suppose somebody disappointed composer. Yes.
Yeah, I think a real composer writes, hopefully, likes to be heard all the time. Nobody writes just to put it in the closet. On the other hand, if you're convinced this is what you have to do, you keep on writing whether it's performed or not. And a commitment is a commitment. And if you're committed to writing, there's only one way, and that's to do it.
Yes.
And then, of course, you hope it is performed. All of us who write have certain work, and you're surprised that a certain work will be played all over the place, and another one, which you feel is great and perhaps even better, may get very few performances in season. And you don't know, you have no explanation. But nevertheless, the next piece has to be the best that you can do anyway. History and time takes care of a lot of little things.
Doesn't it?
And a composer does not write for that immediate success. He knows before he starts that's not the life of the composer. The life of the composer is simply producing the best he knows how.
Right. Now, one of the questions I'm supposed to ask you was, what was your reaction when you received the commission from the Louisville Orchestra? What was your thought? Did you know about the Louisville Orchestra? Had you heard about it?
I had heard about the commissioning program, which had just shortly started, I think. And I accepted it with great enthusiasm because, again, it was one of the unique things that was happening in American music. It was commissioning composers, a stature at the time. That's before you got to me.
But
it was quite the time. It was composers of stature and rehearsing it, and then very shortly the whole recording program, I think, is a very important part of American musical history.
Well, this is that's why we're here, because we do feel that, and I must say, after being here a week, I'm more convinced than ever that it is important.
I'm sure you feel that the whole project is still very much alive.
Yes, and I'm quite astonished that how strongly each one of you that we've spoken to this week, and the eighth one, there's been not the slightest hesitation in emphasizing you.
Now, as a matter of fact, in the case of Louisville, when I did get the commission, I tried at that time to write the best and the grandest piece I could write, because I did write my sixth symphony for you.
Yes.
And it, as you know, it's a terribly rough work.
I remember it was very difficult to do. You remember I had an awful struggle with it. You had to help me quite a bit.
No, but it's a rough piece, and it's, it requires enormous stamina, and I've learned since that time that it's not so much the difficulty to say, but the stamina. It has such broad lines that it requires a great deal of an effort. But I really did want to write the very best piece I possibly could for that.
Really, very eloquent piece, and I not only played it in Louisville, but when I went down to South America, I played it in San Diego, where it made a very good success. And but as I remember, you had to help me quite a bit after you got there with it, with the mastering of it.
Well, I don't know if it was help, but it was, I remember several pleasant evenings that we were talking about it and going through it. And
yeah.
And
well, this was close to fun of it, it seems to me. Actually, I had my experience as a conductor had been limited to, for the most part, to an orchestra which had been originally almost an amateur group, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And although I had developed some skills, it wasn't until this very period that the pressure of having to produce so much music compelled me to become a conductor, whether I wanted to do or not. And of course, mm-hmm. I did want to very badly. By this time, I was very much enamored of it. I suppose most musicians really would like to conduct. I get that impression. Not all, but most. And it is an exciting profession. And yet, in my case, I sort of stumbled into it kind of by accident.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden, was kicked into it head first, where week after week, I had to do a new piece.
Yeah,
it performed miracles for me.
Well, there's no greater way to learn when you have to do something and you learn so much and so quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Because most musicians have the time to prepare at their own pace and then occasionally add a new verse. You were really learning new works all the time.
Yes, some weeks I had to learn two pieces in the same week. That wasn't often, but it did happen, which was really a little too much. But I, like yourself, when this is Bill Schumann laying his day out, the way he works, we all have a work method. Once I got started in this thing and realized what I was in for, 42 mm-hmm. pieces a year, or thereabouts, or 30 at least some, I worked out a schedule whereby I could estimate, and by this time I began to know the players very well, and I would lay out an estimate of how much time each piece would take. And I got so I could be very, very accurate. And of course, I always cheated on the standard repertory because the other things mm-hmm. were more difficult. And besides, I was more interested in them. And I always got
fortunate for that.
I also had the satisfaction mm-hmm. that when the composer was pleased, he told me so. And mm-hmm. that was always the most gratifying thing. And Beethoven and Brahms and the other chaps went around to give him much encouragement.
Yeah.
So that was how the six came about, and I remember the lovely slow movement, the lyric beauty of it, and the fiery finale.
Yeah, the finale was rather
dramatic. Mr. Manning, could you give us a few program notes to help our listeners, the piece he played in connection with this interview?
The six pieces, that well, the composer, I think, is his worst program annotated, because
don't need to be program annotated,
yeah.
It's just helpful hints of your thoughts.
It's a work in three movements, and I can just very briefly say that there's an opening slow section in which there's a kind of a cantus firmus-like idea which I bring back often throughout the symphony. But the first movement then goes into a rather dramatic allegro, based on several of the motives that were introduced. And the whole second movement, I think, is the whole idea was to write long, as beautiful a melodic line as I could, and it gets rather impassioned.
Yes, you have the long melodic line, which is rather common in those days.
Now, and something that still is with me, I still find, for me, some of the great pleasures in music happen to be lines that continue and don't sag, so to speak.
They seem to pick up and display themselves.
Exactly.
Along, yeah.
I have a great interest in the Baroque slow movements. For instance, a Bach slow movement, I just happen to love. Not that mine are like that, but they do have this unwinding kind of...
one long, continuous melody.
Self-propelling,
yeah.
a kind of a melodic line. And then the difference, of course, is you develop that and have further extensions, but I do like cantabile slow movements. And and then the finale, of course, is a very dramatic kind of a very fast and very virtuosic, and
yeah.
that plays great demands on the orchestra. And
I remember the brass parts were quite difficult.
Yeah.
The rhythms, of course, intricate too. Although, not like some composers where every rhythm borrows a different meter.
No, I think the interest and, of the rhythm is not necessarily in changing bars, but within the framework of the bars and going beyond.
And yes, it's strange because, as I recall, the bars are almost all the same.
Yeah, I don't change bars often except for effect. And
yet, rhythmically, it's just
it's very intricate and it uses very much an American rhythm where the offbeat could be the onbeat, so to speak. That's very often what makes it difficult when you have concertina lines. Sometimes it's almost easier for the musician if you change bars where the emphasis is.
Yes, yes.
But in my case, I would be changing so often that it would be a mess. So I try to keep rather uniform bars whenever I can, for the sake of ensemble.
You were very much wedded to the symphony, weren't you, as a form?
Yes, I still love the symphony, and I've written a number of other orchestral works, but I do like the symphony. Yeah, guilty.
That's not even apologize for.
No, I know, except in the earlier stated death now of the symphony orchestra, the symphony as a form has been often said it's a finished form. I don't think there's anything finished. There are good composers and people who can't handle forms, but it depends on who's writing whether a form is alive or not.
That's right, and of course, if we think of symphony form and what we read in the textbooks of kids, you know, Beethoven's idea.
Mm-hmm.
That's one thing, but the symphony, no two symphonies are alive at
not
all.
Not at all. I mean,
even
Mahler,
Beethoven.
Already with Mahler and Berlioz, the symphony takes on a different form and in contemporary. It's only, to me, all it signifies is a work for the orchestra of major proportions in which certain ideas expand and grow.
Mm-hmm.
So from there on in, it can be anything.
Yeah.
But
give you the complete freedom that you need.
I think so.
As a creative artist.
To me, it's like writing a novel. I like a novel. I like short stories too.
Yeah.
But to me, a full-fledged novel, when it's great, is a complete experience.
Yes,
and,
I wonder, did you at any time when you wrote the piece in the honor of Gershwin, for example, was Gershwin a man whose music you admired?
This was not in honor of Gershwin. The prize was in honor of Gershwin.
Oh, I beg your pardon.
No, and it was simply, I had written this Second Symphony a little bit earlier, and then this prize was announced.
I remember the final statement.
And the work was submitted. No, it really had nothing to do with Gershwin.
Were you ever attracted to jazz or that type of music?
In a sense, I don't think any American child can avoid jazz if they listen to music. I've never been interested in writing jazz, but I think there are a lot of jazz elements in my music.
Yeah.
Some of it, I don't think it's obvious, but it's there, just as I think American speech is different than English speech or anybody else's speech. The rhythm is a little different, but I don't consciously go after trying to write jazz, no.
No.
I think it is part of my language and it's deeply embedded there, and that's the way I like it, because I think writing jazz ideas for a large orchestra, it's very difficult to expand into the kinds of forms that I like.
Yeah. Listen, the song is himself when he tried to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It didn't quite work that way.
Yes. Well, it's interesting too, because of course I'm much older than you are, and I can remember as a little boy that Americans had this passionate desire for American music. You know, we had our White Hope at the end of the term of the Chadwick and then like that, and then McDowell was our big star.
Yeah.
And still all along, we felt when we heard the music there, not we, but the world as they heard this music, felt the European touch at all times, which all really never got away from Europe. I think it's maybe a kind of slight season. But on the whole, But now, all of a sudden, about your time, he came on a whole generation people who are writing American music without even thinking about writing American music.
And that's the beauty of it. Really.
That's what I mean. American music had arrived about this time when music became known. And this long inferiority complex that Americans had. Why can't we have great music?
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden we had music that was definitely American. Now how great it was, it remains to be seen.
Well, we'll let history decide. Yeah. I think the main thing is to write it and to produce it.
Yeah.
But I think I was born at a fortunate period where the American battle was somewhat already won. You didn't have to consciously speak American idioms. It was there, and it automatically got into your music unconsciously, and I think that's the healthy way of
it. Nelson, are you got some remarks you'd like to make at this time?
One of the things that our university would like to have you mention is the significance of this particular work. There's one other work that this company did, the Louisville Orchestra also recorded. These two works, we'd like to know what they had meant to you, the recording, the performance and recording by the Louisville Orchestra, what significance they've been to you personally.
Well, I think the recording, I'll start with the sixth since that was recorded first.
It was recorded first.
Yeah. It came at a time that I think meant a great deal to me because I did not have many recordings. I had several, but not of major work. And this was, in a way, the first real major work that was available on disc. And since I was also very happy with the performance, all you have to do is ask the composer, what does it mean to you? And it almost everything. And so it did mean a great deal.
But thank you that you worked that out.
It was available
to anyone who wanted to hear.
Right. That particular symphony happened, as difficult as it was, happened to be one that did get around internationally as well as nationally. But still, once the performance is over, it's over.
Yeah.
And being able to have a record of its performance was very important. As a matter of fact, it had been played in Moscow and Turin and London as well as, you know, some more orchestras here in this country.
You know, I don't realize this.
Oh, really? Right after you did it, Metropolis did it with the Philharmonic.
Really?
And then the Los Angeles Symphony did it, and then it was done in Chicago at the time. So it did get around quite a bit. But no recording. The recording itself was of real importance to me. The Sixth Symphony, which came a little later, there were about three different recordings. I happen to like very much the recording of the Sixth Symphony. I guess Sixth Symphony meant a little bit more because the timing of it came earlier at a time when it meant more.
Mm-hmm.
So that in a sense I was very grateful for it.
Mm-hmm.
And the Sixth Symphony also means a great deal because it's, as you know, the Louisville records are kept for a long time. When you're with a commercial company, after sales get below a certain number, the record is taken off the market.
Yes.
And that's happened with several
It's happened to the biggest names in America.
Oh, I know. And just about a year and a half or two, my second company, which was then with the Chicago Orchestra, finally went below after about 11 years and below a certain number of sales, and that off the market. So it's inevitable that those large.
When you take them off the market, that means you can't get them at all, does it?
I don't think you can get that particular performance,
no.
But that's one of the great things about the Louisville recordings, is they continue to be available.
Well, we're having trouble about that now. We've come on hard times, and we're working with CRI, the people, some way, with their help, we can at least bringing out a few of, how would you put it, David? I think you mentioned that a moment. Mr. Thompson here is more familiar with this problem than I am.
About maintaining the standard?
Yeah.
Well, I personally involved in three release them, you know, we were doing those drops, we didn't feel like it, or our brain can put them like this in the back, release the auditorium.
There should be some place where, for archival purposes, these recordings are kept.
Well, what our hope is that certainly these, the result of this interview, the pieces that we will play in our series at the radio station in at the university, we're in very much in hope that they will become accepted by the National Public Radio and broadcast that way, which would give them a national scope. And so far, from the conversations we've had this week, we feel encouraged that way, don't we? Because without exception, you composers all agree that they are important and do deserve to be to be heard. And Louis Veloz for two made a survey just to find out whether they should abolish the record, because for years it's been a source of financial distress to the society. And I'm happy to say that by a very great majority of the fact that under no circumstances should they be dropped, but they may have to be much reduced in number.
Well, it would be too bad because it is a unique thing. It started it nothing like it, and it would be too bad if it was curtailed, because who else is doing it quite this way?
No one else. No.
No? Well, a great deal of thanks and congratulations go to you for starting the whole project and developing the orchestra.
It wasn't my idea, but I had to do it. So that,
well, you had to do it at least in concert.
That's right. It was a great idea, and I must say I embraced it with enthusiasm when it was suggested to me by Mr. Feinsley.
Well, I think Mayor Feinsley deserves a great deal of thanks from all the composers.
Well, I think he has been thanked, but perhaps not as much as he deserves. But that's apt to be the case. And of course, it is 25, 30 years ago now, and people forget.
I guess it's easy to forget. On the other hand, since the idea was unique, I don't think it's all quite that forgotten. You get used to an idea over the years.
Yes.
But if you talk to composers, you'll get, virtually everyone will give you the same reaction we are, or I am, certainly.
May I ask what you're up to now in your composing these days?
Well, I'm working on a piece for treble voices in a chamber group and another orchestra group.
Yes.
But I've also been working the last year or so on the beginnings of an opera, which I very much want to do. And since it's public domain, I'm not going to mention the subject.
It's not necessary,
But it's I do want to write this opera, and I will be finishing this fall work.
Will this be your first opera?
It'll be the first completed opera. I actually started an opera from 18 years ago on a story that I loved very much and knew that the ending had to be changed. After I had the first act completed, the librettist and I never could quite make the work come to a close. I still have the music, but the opera is not complete. So instead of just wasting time and trying to manufacture a close that I may or may not have been happy with, I thought I'd look around for another subject that would really engulf me and totally convince me, which I think I now have.
Yes. There's extremely difficult, isn't it?
I think the libretto, because these days there are so few stories that lend themselves to an operatic setting. And I don't like the kind of opera in which you virtually declaim everything and you have a few little pieces of music in the background that just support the declamation. Frankly, I get bored to tears with that.
Yes.
I really want something that allows the composer to really write music, the kind of music that he should be writing. And there are so few subjects. This is why I think there are so few operas being written today.
Yeah.
And but I think I've got one, so.
Well, I read also.
Certainly I do, because you spend a great part of your life in writing an opera, and the non-musical aspect as well, the libretto.
Now,
I think before we leave, Mr. Manning, everyone would like to hear his views on the current scene, especially since he's a prominent music educator and a resident of New York for many years. He should know what's going on both educationally and professionally.
Well,
what's happening now in New York and the world?
Well, that's a small subject, but I happen to be an incurable optimist to begin with, because I do hear from time to time pessimistic views that we're producing too many musicians. To begin with, I really don't know what too many means. There's never enough good ones. And I think that there are a great number of outlets and opportunities that I see from the vantage point of our school that, at least 45 and sometimes 50 of the current students are already developing careers while they're going to school. And one of our problems is keeping down the maximum number of concerts that they can both go to school and develop their careers as performers. I think that the performance part of music has greatly increased. I don't think the part of the composers, I can't be as encouraging about composers because it's never been all that luxurious for a composer in terms of being able to have his music performed and whatever he can accrue from the performances. So I don't think that's changed very much. I think that in composition, there's been a greater tendency in recent times for small pocket audiences, a 50 or 60 or 70 for special groups rather than the broader audiences I would have hoped we would have developed. So I think contemporary music has about the same struggle it's always had. And I'm not sure that's going to ever change very much, because once you get a broad audience, you also have to have more of the kind of music that appeals to a broad audience. And very often contemporary music is not that kind of music that appeals that broadly. But from the standpoint of the profession, you know, if you look at a span of 20 or 25 years, there's been an enormous increase. If you look over a period of 4 or 5 years, there's been virtually no increase. I mean, for instance, in former days, an orchestra that had 20 weeks or 25 weeks, that was a big season. Now virtually all the major orchestras have round a year seasons, which in many cases is too much. But at least it is year-round employment. And regardless of the number of threats of strikes and not strikes, we do have more orchestras now than we had 25 years ago or 30 years ago. And I think you can only look at history from the standpoint of at least a couple of decades apart. And for that, I think that we are not necessarily overproducing musicians. From Juilliard's standpoint, we even get letters of criticism from certain orchestras that would like to have applicants, and some of the young people do not apply if it isn't in an area that they would like to live. And then perhaps we'll go to another place further away when it happens to be a place they do want. I think young musicians are picking areas that they want to live, as well as, I'm thinking about orchestral musicians, because of course the touring virtuoso lives every place. I think that the level of the orchestras, the general level of the orchestras, slowly been increasing in quality. So I know I could give you some negative aspects, which I prefer not doing, because I think the positive ones really outweigh the negative ones. And
one more item you might comment on is the state of the careers, the new works you've heard in the last 5 years.
There have been, as I mentioned, a lot of them, there have been fewer orchestral work and more of the ensemble size. And when I was referring to these pocket audiences, that's what I was referring to.
Specialized composers.
Yeah, certain groups will perform, at a certain a small hall, and you'll have 50 or 70 or 75 people there, and it'll be interesting. But those audiences have never expanded, so that in a sense, in some cases, composers are really performing for other composers.
This is what's always troubled me. By the conductor, you know, for nearly 30 years effort to make contemporary music, acceptable. It seems so often that the composer was not trying very hard to reach a general audience. Not in every case, and I didn't mean that they should have to write the light opera music on the record, but I remember one very distinguished composer who, one of the most distinguished, I would say, living today, and he wrote a particularly difficult work to listen to, extremely difficult. And he came over to my house for a while. He had to wait to accept his plane baggage that we got in the summer evening. And I said, how long do you think it will be before your piece will be accepted by audiences in general? And he said, oh, I don't think it will take very long. He said, when I was a boy and in school, I came home and vacation time, and my parents said, play some music for our friends here. So he said, I played some pieces by Debussy, and he said, they were absolutely baffled. They couldn't make head and tail of it. Was that music? And he said, now, of course, music like this is played in pop country. And he said, that was what, 40 years ago? Well, I don't know. His music, however, was our friend.
Well, I think that there are a number of pieces that can sound very gritty at the moment and will be accepted, but in the last 10 to 15 years, we've had a great deal of a certain kind of experimentation, which really has nothing to do with music. And then there is the kind of experimentation that's hard to take, but does have to do with music.
Yeah.
So I think there's been a little bit trying to bring some of the other arts attitudes in some of the music performances. For instance, you're going on stage and busting balloons with a needle or a cigarette. You know, it's sometimes how naughty we grown-up boys can be kind of an attitude.
Yeah.
It really has nothing to do with the arts. It has to do only with attention-grabbing. But that you ignore.
Yeah.
I think we've had more of that in recent times than we did in the past. But that, like anything else, will go.
It's already started.
It's been going,
yeah.
Not fast enough, but it's going. But, you know, the thing that worries me is very often composers of great seriousness who are not easy to take, but write music as clearly as they can, and it is quick, but it requires an audience's very serious attention. Very often that music is ignored because it's tough to take at that time. And yet, for instance, this little third symphony that of mine that was written in 1945, and there were split opinions on it when it was first done. It happened to be highly contrapuntal, which sometimes makes demands on listening. But I thought it was very clear. It was not received with wild open arms, but about 15 years later, I had the enjoyment of the same major critic who tore into it, of writing about the same piece as if you'd never heard it before, and praising it to the skies, and it delighted me to just send them the piece, the earlier piece, and he was a gentleman about it. He says, well, in the meantime, I grew up. But that kind of a piece, I think history will always have. It'll either be hard to take at one a certain time, and then the audiences will catch up with it. But there are some pieces that audiences not only will never catch up with it, they shouldn't, because there's really no music there. You know, so I think it's something you can't harness and channel into thinking. There's always going to be a lot of music that does not deserve hearing and does not deserve repetition. And there's also going to be some very great music that is neglected.
Yeah.
And I really don't know that answer at all, except that time
needs to be.
Sure, and time will sooner or later just the good from the bad, and I don't know of any other way.
No. Well, Peter, you've been very generous to see.
No, it's been a lot of fun to see you.
After your recent illness and all. Peter Menon has been a friend for a good many years, and he caught him at an unfortunate time when he recovered from surgery, and
well,
he's been very generous to see us. And
well, I wouldn't have missed this, and actually the surgery part is behind me now, and I'm happy about that.
Of course you are. I'm glad to see you so cheerful. Yeah. And it's very encouraging to talk to you, too, because yours is one of the more cheerful notes on the subject.
In a way, I'm sorry to hear that. I wish there were more.
They're about equally divided. I suggested that it'd be wonderful to get all 10 of these New York composers together in one room, at which my two colleagues said, oh, no, that would never do. But we would get some marvelous conversations.
Yes.
Maybe some. Maybe get some fisticuffs also. But
well, sometimes composers even listen.
For instance, Virgil Thompson said that he thought creative arts were in a cross right now, and I don't think he agreed with that at all.
Not at all. No.
Okay. And one or two others did, but more disagreed, as you did. So it depends on one's viewpoint.
And the gross part of his age, too. Virgil Thompson's an old man now. You have to take it back to you.
Well, he was.
Yes.
Well, listen, it's been a lot of fun reviewing our past and seeing you again.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Ralph.